welcome to the Lynn Rivers Show. I'm Lynn Rivers. From the dictionary, corruption, dishonest or fraudulent conduct by those in power, typically involving bribery. Conspiracy, a secret plan by a group to do something unlawful or harmful. On today's show, we'll be talking about both corruption and conspiracy. We'll start with the Occupy movement and what my guest says is a coordinated effort by cities across the nation to break up demonstrations and squelch dissent. We'll also talk with notorious Washington insider Jack Abramoff about corruption in that city. Let's start with conspiracy. My guest is Sean Gaynor from the San Francisco Bay Guardian. Welcome, Sean.
Hello.
Hi. Why don't you give us a little bit about your background and about the Guardian?
Hello. I'm a regular contributor to the Guardian. I've come out to San Francisco from North Carolina, where I used to work for Alt News Weekly called the Asheville Global Report. And now I'm out here working for the Bay Guardian, which is one of the country's oldest alt-weekly newspapers.
Okay. So how did you begin to cover the Occupy movement? We're going to talk about that today. How did you get involved in that?
Well, I came a little bit late to covering the Occupy movement from other beats. And I came into the Occupy movement covering it during the general strike in Oakland, which was a pretty extraordinary event out here. Probably in excess of 25,000 people shut down the port of Oakland, and it was the first general strike in this area since 1946, so it was quite a significant event for us out here.
Was the one in 46 a labor strike?
It was a labor strike. It was a port strike also, I believe, against Kaiser Shipping, just in the post-World War II era, as the war economy kind of faded away, and the Great Depression was still fresh in people's minds. There was some labor unrest as the country was recovering from the war.
Right, and their wages had been frozen during the wartime. So yeah, I remember that was happening. Let's talk a little bit about your reporting on the idea or the issue of this organization, PERF, and we'll talk about what that stands for in a minute, has coordinated by conference calls mayor's offices, police departments, private law enforcement people in as many as 40 cities. Talk to us about what PERF is.
Well, first I'd like to clarify about PERF coordinating. Now, when I say that PERF is coordinating, I say that they're providing the forum, they're arranging the calls, they're bringing these police chiefs together in this forum. So when they're coordinating, they're not usurping local control from those local chiefs. The control is still with them. They're just providing the forum where the conversation is happening. And what's problematic about that is that PERF is a nonprofit organization. And when the Police Executive Research Forum brings these people together, it does it outside of the realm of government, where we don't have the access we normally have to see what is being discussed.
So there's no transparency.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, now you've mentioned that there are up to 40 cities that are turning to these folks for advice, for training. What's the evidence of that?
Well, there's been a smattering of reports and leaks from various officials involved in the call. You know, some people will say they're on the call, that a chief was on the call, and that chief will deny it. And so it's hard to pin down exactly who was on the call. But the way PERF works is, as an organization, as a nonprofit, PERF is a membership organization. And the threshold for membership is that you have to be a police chief, and you have to be from a large city. You have to be from a city of more than 50,000 people and have a police force of more than 100 officers. And that's the threshold for membership. And those members pay dues into PERF as a professional association. And So that's what PERF's membership is made up of. It's a very, very exclusive group.
So are they operating exclusively on membership fees, or are they raising money? And if they are, where is the money coming from?
They are not operating exclusively from membership fees. They are raising some money. From what I've taken a look at, there is some corporate sponsorship. Motorola was one of the sponsors. But we don't see money coming from unusual sources into their organization.
Now, in my research, I downloaded their blueprint. You mentioned that in your article, that they have a written blueprint for dealing with mass political protests. This is a pretty hefty document. Can you summarize it for us?
Well, there's actually two documents that PERF has concerning protests. One is Managing Major Events, the Best Practices Field Manual. And Managing Major Events is more broad than just political protests. It talks about sporting events, and it talks about other, mass gatherings of people and how to manage those. It does specifically talk about protests in there, and it's troubling that when it does, it kind of fixates on this idea of anarchists and eco-terrorists, domestic terrorists. And when it talks about the famous protests in Seattle in 1999 against the WTO, it talks about protesters in those terms as terrorists. And I think we see this follow through into how some of these protesters are treated in the streets.
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of news coverage that sort of portrays them as being lawless. Well, listeners, I want to remind you that this is the Lynn Rivers Show right here on 89.1 WEMU, and my guest today is Sean Gaynor from the San Francisco Bay Guardian. We are talking about the Occupy movement. So Sean, let me ask you about, in the document I looked at, there are references to the FBI, there are pictures of FBI personnel. Is there some sort of collaboration between government agencies and this organization?
Well, there's certainly collaboration between government agencies and the and PERF. The director of PERF, Chuck Wexler, sits on the Civilian Advisory Panel to Homeland Security, which is a really high-level panel of civilian contractors and think tank personnel that help Homeland Security kind of develop our national policies. So there is that overlap there. But the other tie is that PERF's membership being exclusively police chiefs, PERF's membership is made up of officials of our government.
Mm-hmm. Now, we're looking at this question of whether or not there is some sort of organization across the country in terms of response. Is there evidence to suggest that that many cities are responding in the same way and responding according to the PERF blueprint?
Well, there's evidence to suggest that when they respond, they're certainly talking about it in the same way. They're, repeating these talking points, pairing up health and public safety issues against the constitutional issues of assembly and free speech, and making a judgment that health and public safety, no matter how minor the concerns, kind of supersede these issues, these constitutional issues around assembly. Now, I think what PERF is doing is once again just providing the forum for this conversation. But if you have members of an organization who are meeting regularly and conferencing regularly, the idea that they can come to a consensus about an issue they're facing is a reasonable one. It's not a conspiratorial idea.
Mm-hmm. So are they providing training as well? Certainly there are written documents, but do they have events? Do they bring together police agencies from around the country for training?
They certainly bring them from around the country for conferencing. I would imagine that some degree of training happens at that conferencing. Recently, they were gathered in Philadelphia for a conference on social media. And during that conference, they took a trip down to the Occupy encampment. Both PERF's board chair, Chief Ramsey of Philadelphia, and PERF's executive director, Chuck Wexler, were were there at the Occupy movement together, kind of observing how social media is being used within the Occupy movement.
Let me go back to this issue of the anarchists at the WTO. In the news coverage, when mayors in the bigger cities talk, they sort of make it like these people are anarchists. Is there any suggestion that anywhere in the country, particularly in the areas you cover, that these protesters are engaging in violent acts or are somehow other than peaceful?
I haven't witnessed any violent acts on the part of the protesters during my coverage. During the general strike, there was a little bit of vandalism, just some minor vandalism where individuals who were frustrated, it seemed like, acted out. But, you know, maybe I saw three or four vandals out of the 20,000 people I saw during the general strike. So I think it's really isolated in these isolated instances. Are being picked up and repeated in the media as if there's some sort of plan or coordination for destruction.
Let me ask you about a couple of events. One on your beat, which is Oakland. Huge demonstration, lots of problems in terms of police action there. Explain it to my listeners about what happened.
Well, I wasn't in Oakland for the first clearing of the camp and the subsequent demonstration, but colleagues of mine were out covering that report, and the police reaction seemingly was excessive. There were people severely injured. There was an Iraq war veteran who was shot in the head with a tear gas canister and ended up in critical condition over that. Now it seems like he's making a full recovery, but I think it was a scary moment for our community to see a veteran like that injured while participating in our democratic processes.
Well, hasn't there been sort of a long-standing issue about police activities in Oakland? I mean, you have had situations where you've had people die in custody. You've had a man killed on the public transit system. Talk a little bit about
right.
The relationship between the community and the police there.
Well, it's certainly a tense relationship. A young man, Oscar Grant, an Oakland resident, was shot on the platform, on the train platform, on New Year's Day 2 years ago. And that shooting was recorded by people on their cell phone cameras. And what we saw after that was a real backlash against the Oakland police and the BART police, which were the transit police involved in the shooting. Now, the Oakland police weren't involved in that incident, but as the community outrage built around that incident, the Oakland police were involved in policing that outrage. And so I think that's where they got somewhat of a black eye in the community. And that's a wound that hasn't healed in Oakland, that Oscar Grant incident. And the city plaza in Oakland, where the occupiers have had their occupation throughout most of this, they've renamed Oscar Grant Plaza. So you can tell that this incident, even though it's a couple years behind us, has really affected the reputation of both the Bay Area Rapid Transit Police and the Oakland Police Department in our area.
I was amazed when I read that the transit police are armed. What's the reasoning there?
Well, I would imagine that the reasoning they would say is public safety. Now there was a second transit shooting, one that was over this summer, and it was in San Francisco, not Oakland. The transit system connects roughly 30 cities. And after this second shooting on a train platform, the one over the summer, which I believe happened on 4th of July, so again at this holiday time, at one of these, you know, heightened times of awareness, and in response to that, protesters have been calling for the BART police to be disarmed, but BART has indicated that they have no intention of disarming.
Mm-hmm. Part of his beat is covering the Occupy movement. Sean, we were talking about the situation in Oakland. the use of tear gas there. I mean, yes, it was a large protest, but the use of tear gas seemed excessive. Is tear gas and pepper spray within the blueprint? Are those the kinds of things that PERF talks about or recommends?
They certainly talk about it. I wouldn't say they blanketly recommend it. They recommend, you know, examining the situation and then moving forward with their plan, whatever that plan is. I think in Oakland it certainly was excessive. You have a mixed crowd of you know, elderly and children, and you know, the Occupy movement has been really broadly represented in Oakland. There's no specific segment of the population that's out there on the street. So there's, you know, some of our more vulnerable populations present. And the tear gas is just absolutely indiscriminate. It blows down the street. It blows into businesses. And what it seems to do is, you know, once the police are in a situation where they're firing tear gas, the crowd gets very agitated. You know, they're suddenly exposed to pain. They feel the panic of the rest of the crowd. And PERF at times does discuss not using tear gas for those reasons. They kind of leave it as a judgment call thing. Former PERF chair and former Miami police chief Timoney, he has a chapter in there where he talks about tear gas being a detriment to crowd control because
incites.
Because it's just not effective, calming the crowd.
Let's talk about who's on the PERF, in the PERF leadership. Who's on the board of governors there, or the corporate board?
Well, it is nonprofit, so it has a board of directors. And PERF's board of directors is chaired by Charles Ramsey. Now, Charles Ramsey, he's the chief in Philadelphia right now, but he spent the majority of his career as the chief of the D.C. Metro Police. And during that time, he was in charge of D.C.'s response to the anti-globalization and anti-war protests of the early 2000s, where we saw a large degree of brutality, a lot of mass arrest, and this brutality has been proven in lawsuits subsequently, and the mass arrest has been proven to be an illegal preemptive move against people's First Amendment rights.
When the police show up in riot gear, I've seen clips of that, but also when I was at the national convention, the Democratic convention in Los Angeles, not only did they have riot gear on, we turned a corner in the cab and came across people on horseback, a whole row of mounted police. Is that sort of thing happening? Are there threatening kinds of actions on the police part meant to intimidate?
I don't know what it's meant for. It certainly looks intimidating. Now, out here, there isn't a lot of use of police horses, but there are a lot of police departments around the country that continue to use horses in riot control. New York is particularly noted for that. They have a very large segment of horses, as does D.C. You know, PERF's document has a lot of discussion about this use of what they call the turtle suit, the riot gear, and what they have to say about that is that for as long as a crowd is peaceful, you should keep the riot police away because they agitate people. They incite fear in people. They incite panic in people. They incite resentment in people. Unlike PERF's 2006 document, police management of mass demonstrations, their current document kind of takes a wait-and-see attitude with the deployment of these riot police into crowd situations. Because I think what we've seen over the last 10 years is that when riot police form a line across the street and start trying to move a crowd, that they agitate that crowd.
Mm-hmm. This is the Lynn Rivers Show, and we are talking with Sean Gaynor from the San Francisco Bay Guardian. We're talking about the Occupy movement right here on 89.1 WEMU. Sean, several mayors have said that situations have escalated because the crowd represents a threat to the people. The Davis chancellor mentioned that when she was responding to the pepper spray of peaceful demonstrators. Is there anything to suggest out where you are that the crowd is in some way threatening the police or is behaving in a way that should make the police fear for their safety?
I haven't witnessed anything like that, and I'll say I wasn't at Davis, but I certainly have reviewed the videos, and from what I could see, it was protesters, you know, sitting down in the most stereotypical of peaceful protests. They were sitting locking arms, and so how that's translated into a threatening situation, I'm not sure. I do know that the police who were involved in that incident came in from off campus and were called in from off campus. So it's possible that in their communication internally, that the officers were put into a situation that was less tense than they were expecting when they came up. But I don't really see any justification of pepper spraying college students who are, you know, engaged in civics, engaged in democracy.
Now, the university that you have close to you is Berkeley. Can you talk about what went on at Berkeley?
Berkeley's had a very relatively long-standing struggle within the university system about tuition hikes since the recession started. So there's been a really strong student movement in Berkeley for about 2.5 years now. And that movement came out, and they had an occupation of Sproul Plaza, which is the plaza that's famous for the free speech movement. And the Berkeley police came out, and once again, from video shot overhead, appeared to attack the crowd, attack students, and do so in a way where even the chancellor of the University of Berkeley has had to come out and say that it was excessive.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that Homeland Security at least consults with these folks. What is the role of Homeland Security, and what are they protecting the homeland from?
Well, Homeland Security has more crossover than other government agencies into the private world. And as it was conceived, I believe they made that crossover in order to increase their information networks, increase their participation. And so what we see at this point is groups like PERF and groups like private contractors that are advising Homeland Security on policy. Now that's problematic because, you know, as a private organization, they have their own interests in mind. But I don't perceive their role as anything more than an advisory role.
Now, observers are saying that the sort of aggressive pushback from the police, cleaning out Zuccotti Park, et cetera, is going to diminish the protests. In other words, that this eviction is sort of the end of demonstrations. As you look at interventions out there where you are, is it hurting the movement or is it helping the movement?
It's hard to weigh day by day whether it's hurting or helping the movement. On one hand, these parks, these squares and plazas that the protesters have taken have become important symbols of their movement. On the other hand, their movement's energy is moving in a lot of new directions. We had a house out here that was occupied yesterday in Oakland that was slated for foreclosure, and the family was moved back in. So that's one direction that things are taking out here. Another direction that the movement's really taking out here is these issues surrounding our ports and labor issues with the ports. So there's been a port strike called by Occupy Oakland that, unlike the general strike, which closed the Port of Oakland, is aiming to close the West Coast ports for a day. So the Occupy movement is certainly a young phenomenon, and it's developing its political character. And we'll just have to wait and see if these physical plazas are remain the focus of the Occupy movement, or if they move on to other approaches.
So would you say that this is a broad effort? It's not just students complaining about tuition. It is a much larger issue that brings lots of people together?
Yeah, I think I've been covering social movements for about 10 years now, and certainly when we saw the anti-globalization movement, we saw a really broad section of American society support that movement, labor unions, environmentalists, students. But I would say the Occupy movement is the broadest movement I've seen, certainly in Oakland, to date. It really crosses a lot of racial boundaries. Labor is involved, environmentalists are involved, advocates for the poor are involved, our youth are involved, and so there's a real true cross-section of Oakland represented out on the streets there. There's so many protest signs that I see say, we are the 99%, and when I look around at the variety of people, everything from, you know, teachers and librarians and other professionals who have been really influential in the Occupy movement out here, to our homeless populations and our most vulnerable who have also been active in supporting the Occupy movement. It's really a broader cross-section of America than we normally see on the same side in American politics.
Mm-hmm. Sean Gaynor, I want to thank you for joining me here today. It's been a fascinating conversation.
Thank you.
That was Sean Gaynor from the San Francisco Bay Guardian. This is the Lynn Rivers Show on 89.1 WEMU. Recently on this show, we focused on the U.S. Supreme Court case commonly called Citizens United, the outcome of which is that corporations can give unlimited amounts of money to political campaigns without having to divulge where that money came from. Here's part of that conversation I had with former Congressman Republican Joe Schwartz and Chief Counsel of the Constitutional Accountability Center, Elizabeth Wydra. This is a case, this is one we all know about, we've all heard about, and it comes up again and again. So, Elizabeth, I'm going to turn to you. Lay the scenario out for us. What was the dispute here?
Well, you know, Citizens United actually didn't start out as Citizens United as we know it. It began as a fairly sleepy case. During the 2008 presidential primary season, a corporation called Citizens United planned to release a film critical of Senator Hillary Clinton, who was then running for president, entitled Hillary the Movie, through video on demand, a pay-per-view service. It, in its Supreme Court appeal, Citizens United argued that it had a First Amendment right to an exemption from campaign finance regulations because a feature-length film, which would be seen only by the viewers willing to pay for it, was fundamentally different from the 30 or 60-second broadcast ads that Congress had targeted in preventing certain corporate campaign expenditures. Of course, this all changed when, on the very last day of the 2008 October term, the Supreme Court, sua sponte, on its own, ordered new briefing on whether two key precedents, including a part of McConnell versus the Federal Election Commission, which had just been decided in 2003, should be overruled. And so with that, the court held a special session, which is very, very rare, on September 9th, 2009, and the court reheard arguments. And after that, the Supreme Court issued its ruling in Citizens United that you heard President Obama speak of, and that's how we got to the case that we have now.
Well, there are a number of things that happen before we get to this. And the dispute, of course, is around money in politics, corporate money in politics. The Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act is sort of not necessarily at the heart. The heart is really about money, corporations, the Constitution. But let's talk a little bit about the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act. Now, Joe, when you got to Congress, this was already being challenged. What was the concern? What were people opposed to?
Well, everything. If you want to be out there just kind of freelancing in electoral financing, becomes an emanation from a penumbra of the First Amendment. And that was always the case. McCain-Feingold really trampled on people's First Amendment rights. You could do anything you want. You could give any amount of money you wanted, and so on. And I think that led up to Citizens United, where now you can do precisely that. And not only can you give any amount you want, it's never going to be traced back to you if you give it to the right 501c4. So we've come a long way, and quite frankly, it's the wrong way.
Well, one of the things that I remember, I was in Congress and part of the group that worked on BCRA, the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act. One of the concerns was that there was this big loophole in regulation of campaign spending, campaign donations, and that was the so-called issue ad. Elizabeth, why don't you explain that to us?
So the idea is that under this loophole for the issue ad, a corporation could spend money that's not technically donated directly to a candidate, which would be prohibited, but rather does everything but advocate for the election or defeat of a certain candidate. And so in a sense, it would be an extension of advocating for that particular candidate, even though it would claim to be just about, labor issues or drilling or something like that.
Well, this wasn't just corporations. The parties were doing this. Various other groups were doing it.
Yes, right.
And so, I mean, is it fair to say that what the Reform Act was trying to do is it was trying to make sure that money spent in actual electioneering and campaigning was being spent in the way that was or was coming into the campaign in a way that was legal?
Correct.
Great. Okay, so we get the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act, but there's more to the story before that. So, Elizabeth, we got a series of cases. I was going to say let's do Buckley v. Valeo, but let's go back to the early 1900s and explain to us the history of regulating campaign money.
Yeah, absolutely. So, the idea that through the law, we could prevent improper corporate influence on the electoral process has been a pillar of our modern democracy. Concern that corporations were corrupting elections motivated passage of the Tillman Act of 1907, which is really the first piece of federal corporate campaign finance legislation. And it also was a motivating factor behind the ratification of the 17th Amendment, which gives individuals in each state the right to directly vote for their U.S. senator instead of having the state legislatures do it.
Mm-hmm. So Joe, let me turn to you because we start with the limitations on corporate activity in 1907. Come the war years, Congress takes another look at it, and this time they focus on unions. What was the law around union participation?
I don't know precisely what the law around union participation is, but I can say that I can recall, because I am a gentleman of a certain age now, there was regulation, and unions were prevented from doing certain things, as were corporations. And the money, and the thing that I liked about it then that I don't particularly care for now, is that the money had to be accounted for. And I never cared one way or the other whether unions participated either for or against me, or individuals who obviously were representing the corporation who employed them but writing checks with their own signature on them were for or against me. The thing that bothers me more than anything else now is that there is no accountability. And money corrupts, and the way things are right now, money corrupts totally, completely.
I happen to agree with you, particularly when that money cannot be traced in any way, shape, or form. Huge numbers of dollars coming into the process. But I want to sort of look at the legal path this takes, because we find in the early 1900s, Congress is regulating contributions into federal campaigns. They add unions to corporations in terms of union dues money during the war years. And everybody seems to accept that. The court says that that's a reasonable thing to do. Why, Elizabeth?
Our first sort of modern campaign finance ruling came in 1971 when the Justice Powell on the Supreme Court wrote a it's the early 70s, not exactly 1971, wrote in First National Bank of Boston versus Bilotti that corporations had a right to spend money in proposition elections or referendum on a particular issue. So he held that corporations did have the right to spend, even though they had previously been prohibited. Now, that was vigorously dissented from by Justice Rehnquist, who had become the chief and who was, no liberal. And he said, this is not right. Our Constitution and our legal history has always distinguished between an individual and a corporation. And this makes eminent sense, because corporations are given special privileges like perpetual life and limited liability that are beneficial in the economic sphere, but, as Rehnquist said, pose special dangers in the political sphere. That was sort of really the first time that we had these two warring camps over the appropriateness of campaign corporate finance regulation.
That was part of a conversation I had on this show recently with former Republican Congressman Joe Schwartz and chief counsel of the Constitutional Accountability Center, Elizabeth Wydra. Joining me now is former Washington lobbyist and convicted felon Jack Abramoff. He is the author of the new book, Capital Punishment, The Hard Truth About Washington's Corruption from America's Most Notorious Lobbyists. So, Jack, I always ask every author, why write this book and why write it now?
Well, for me, first of all, why write it now? I was in prison for a good period of time before I had a chance to write this book. And as to why to write this book, I wanted to do two things. One, I wanted to get out to the American public what's actually going on behind those closed doors in Washington, those doors I operated behind, in a way that, frankly, nobody talks about it, because